I say what we need is a renaissance. Now that's a familiar word for most people.
Connect. Okay, now I'm connected. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The time now is 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Although freedom is an ideal all sides of the American political spectrum espouse, the latest book by Vanderbilt University historian Jefferson Cowie reveals a long history of the ways white supremacist ideas of freedom have become deeply embedded into our politics. Freedom's Dominion, a saga of white resistance to federal power, is published by Basic Books and brings Jefferson Cowie to our show now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Leonard.
Oh, this is really important stuff. You've titled your book's introduction, George Wallace and American Freedom, and you open with Wallace's inaugural address as governor of Alabama, which was, in effect, a defense of Southern segregation. But why do you open the book there?
Yeah, the January 1963 inaugural of George Wallace is certainly his most famous speech. But I turn it around a little bit because that's the speech where he says segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, which was him drawing the line against the civil rights movement and federal support for civil rights legislation. If you go back through that speech, as I did very carefully, you notice he used the word segregation four times. Three times, one other time. He used freedom or liberty two dozen times. And so I open with an analysis of that speech because I'm trying to capture how Wallace saw himself, which was as a defender of a very specific version of American freedom. And that is
well,
the
Wallace.
Freedom.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I was just going to say that he saw himself defending the people of Alabama and certainly the people of his own Barber County against the incursions of the federal government that would dictate to them how they had to act. And that would be his words, not mine, of course.
And he said in that inaugural speech, "Let us rise to the call of freedom-loving blood that is in us and send our answer to the tyranny that clanks its chains upon the South." So he was issuing a challenge to the federal government.
That's right. His entire career, essentially, is a challenge to the federal government. He made his reputation as the fighting judge of Alabama because he fought against the Federal Elections Commission of the late 50s. What we need to understand is that the connections between this sort of dominating, racialized, white supremacist version of freedom is deeply connected to this anti-federal, anti-statist kind of vision for how America should work. That really goes all the way back to a kind of, awkwardly, a Jeffersonian Republican value.
Well, he was it a matter of freedom is racialized anti-statism?
Right, yeah, that's that's the shortest version I could come up with. So freedom as racialized anti-statism. I want to be clear, when I say anti-statism, I really mean anti-federal power, because these people used state power, local power, and even federal power when it suited their needs. So that anti-statism is really kind of a shortened version for incursion of federal forces in their local affairs. And at that particular point and throughout the history, what that often meant was the federal government threatened the balance of power that they owned in local race and labor relations.
1964, when he ran for president for the first time, he said, quote, being a Southerner is no longer geographic. It's a philosophy and an attitude.
Right. Yeah. You know, Wallace.
So he was saying that this applied to people all over the country?
Yeah, and he actually said that in his inaugural, too. He was running for president the minute he took the podium in January 1963 in his gubernatorial inaugural. And so he begins this, he understands that this idea of anti-federal power, this freedom from federal authority, worked not just in the Deep South, but it had a resonance throughout the entire country. And so, you know, he says, you rock-ribbed New Englanders and you patriotic Midwesterners and stuff, you are all Southerners too. And this is how he begins to formulate his national agenda when he runs for president in 64, 68, 72, and 76, basically trying to cull those powers of federal anti-federal power, and which is a more sophisticated position than just white supremacy or racism that came across in that segregation now, segregation forever phrase, which is actually written by a Klansman. And so by
but he read it
together anti-statism, anti-federal power with that, he will naturally draw in that. Now he found he could also appeal to anti-tax types. People were tired of federal incursion in a variety of ways, right? And so you can create a sort of coalition around that anti-federal power agenda.
Now, you've written about Wallace before. Does he remain an important figure in Southern politics, and do liberals tend to underestimate his relevance to our history?
Yeah, well, the funny thing about this book is, as you know, it's a local history of this county.
Barber County, Alabama.
And where Wallace is from. And I actually started researching that county before I figured out Wallace was from there. And when I found out he was from there, and I was sort of knocked back on my heels and realized that it was fate that I should write this, because I'd written about Wallace in my 1970s book and other books. So, yeah, we underestimate him at our peril, I think, all of us, because it's not Wallace the figure, but the idea that he had there, and that he really represents the shifting political dynamics of the late 60s, early 70s, and that create sort of the political foundation of our own time. And that is, as Kevin Phillips, Nixon's analyst back in the day, said that the Wallace voter is moving from a Democratic past to a Republican future. And so here we see the reorientation of the South away from the Democratic Party. We see that a sort of white blue collar uprising against the Democratic establishment. And we see moneyed interests also moving away from the Democratic Party, all sort of clustered around this idea that federal authority was questionable.
So would Wallace today be a MAGA Republican?
This is an interesting question, because Wallace, you know, late in life, Wallace looked around and basically said, everybody's talking like I was talking. Clinton is talking like Reagan was talking like them. You know, he was at one point he said he wished he had royalties on some of his phrases, because everybody was talking like him. He was a deeply, deeply partisan individual, though. So whether I presume he would have eventually shifted the Republican Party like Strom Thurmond, other people did. But he one of my favorite quotes about George Wallace is, somebody said that if you dropped Wallace in the Albanian countryside, he'd be, you know, a member of the Politburo in a number of years. it didn't matter what the expression was; he was a political beast, and his blood pumped politics, and he would find a way to rise to political power no matter what the partisan thing is. So my guess is probably except he was really shrewd, a lot shrewder than a lot of the MAGA Republicans.
You say you began working on this book with a look at Barber County, Alabama. How far back into its history has Barber County been engaged in struggles over land, citizenship, and democracy? For example, when white settlers wanted land from the Indians.
Right. So the story begins literally with one federal marshal heading into this 9-county region along the Chattahoochee River, the border between Alabama and Georgia. And he has orders from Andrew Jackson and his Secretary of War, Cass, to get rid of the white settlers who are infringing upon Creek Indian rights, which is not the kind of idea we normally think of as Jackson. Jackson is the guy of the Trail of Tears and Indian mm-hmm. Removal Act, all true. But in this particular case, he was trying to defend this region as a Creek area. So he basically sends these marshals in to remove white settlers from Indian lands. You know, this is, goes completely counter to the Jacksonian era narrative. And so from the very beginning, and the first marshal basically burns the main town in this county, Barber County, to the ground, not quite to the ground, but several key buildings in this settlement to the ground, and pushes everybody out. And so the birth of this area is essentially in a fight against federal power, federal incursion into local white rights to seize Indian lands.
So they saw freedom as freedom to take land?
Sorry, again?
So they saw freedom as the freedom to take land.
That's right. That's right. And
then those lands were converted into cotton plantations that were worked by slaves. Freedom takes on a whole new meaning in this context.
That is exactly right. Yeah. So this was essentially a contest. I mean, it was the Creek homelands, but it was also happened to be some of the most valuable cotton growing land in the world. So there's a thing called the Intruders War, where the federal government clashes against these white intruders who are coming in to seize lands, and it eventually all goes to hell, and the Creeks lose. But what does happen is, in the name of white freedom, it becomes a plantation-based economy, and slaves are marched in coffles in westward from the old South plantations into this sort of more vicious frontier kind of cotton capitalism that's emerging in this region in the 1830s and 1840s and 1850s.
So the Creek Indians were pushed west.
Right. The Creek Indians lost. So essentially, they begged federal government to help them, please. I have piles of letters of the Creek leaders begging Jackson for more support. His support is tepid. He's not really going to really fight against his core constituency, white yeoman farmers. And he eventually gives up. The Creeks then try to fight back when they realize the federal government's not on their side with violence, and they lose. The federal government comes in, crushes the Creek rebellion, and they are pushed to Oklahoma, where they actually start a town by the very same name, Eufaula, Oklahoma. That is the main town in Barber County, Alabama.
Well, I want to talk about Eufaula in just a moment. But first, I want to alert my audience to the fact that I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie, whose latest book is Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. It's published by Basic Books, and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What about the rise of militant states' rights groups like the Eufaula Regency in the 1950s? Weren't they the first to advocate secession as a viable political option regarding slavery?
They were very much among the first. They were very militant, fire-eating secessionists. But they were very tactical. They were not secession at all costs. They were very engaged in a political process of building a coalition to get out out of the union, and so they weren't just sort of kind of completely wild-eyed secessionists. They really proceeded with a tactical vision about how to do this. But the amazing thing to me, Leonard, is that I'm an historian. You know, I do history for a living. I've been doing this for decades, and for the first time, it really dawned on me that these guys had only had this land for 20 years prior to the Civil War. They were willing to die and have other people die to defend a system that they had seeped in tradition and freedom and all these American values, but it had only been there for 20 years. And then they marched off to war. It's really an amazing story. And to this day, you know, it's still, that area still drips in all this kind of Confederate nostalgia. And it really came home to me that it was only one generation of in the deep South, out in the old, what some call the old Southwest, Alabama, that they were defending something that was brand new, really.
Now you look into how four peak periods in the conflict between white Alabamians and the federal government. The rush, as we were just talking about, to seize and settle lands that belonged to the Creek Nation, Reconstruction, the reassertion of white supremacy under Jim Crow, and the attempts of Wallace and others to nullify the civil rights reforms of the 1950s and 1960s. Is there a continuity there, do you see?
Variation within a story of continuity. And the basic continuity is that local white people defended their freedom to dominate others against the occasional intrusion of federal authority that threatened that sense of freedom. So back to our Creek story, you see the federal government coming in and threatening their freedom to seize Creek lands. And then the next story, as you've suggested, is about Reconstruction. The Civil War really didn't really happen directly in Barbara County. So they were very instrumental in launching the war and fighting the war, but it didn't actually happen there. But Reconstruction was very, very dramatic. And that is, of course, when federal troops occupied the South, rejiggered the balance of power, backed up black citizenship, black voting rights, black contract rights, things like this, not unambiguously by any stretch of the imagination, but compared to anything that had ever happened before, this was an enormous reordering of federal intervention into local affairs.
Well, Congress had to establish martial law in the South in order to put even the small gains of Reconstruction into effect. But you write, federal power has proven itself quite consistently by design and by practice to be inadequate to the basic claims of citizenship of its people.
Right. That's the irony, right? That the federal government is sort of my clay-footed, weak-kneed hero. The federal government comes in, sort of makes promises to the Indians, sort of makes promises to freedmen, sort of makes promises to black citizen, but just enough to kind of stir the pot and then rile up cries for white freedom against federal power, and not quite enough to completely deliver the goods. And that's a world we live in today, I think, when we think about, say, voting rights today.
So how effective was Reconstruction in this area, and was it similar to other parts of the South?
Yeah, Reconstruction worked pretty well. There's the great myth that it failed, that, you know, it gave political power to people who weren't ready for it, and there's a lot of pernicious myths about the nature of Reconstruction, but most of them are basically just racist stories. The there were black people elected to the state assembly. There was a African-American person who was James Rapier, who was elected to Congress, the United States Congress. And so this is really a flourishing of democracy backed up by federal bayonets. Essentially, we will make sure that this works to the best of our ability. When push came to shove, they weren't there for the freedmen. In 1874, a horrible massacre happened at the polls in which whites just rose up and shot black voters in the streets and destroyed that era of Reconstruction for Barber County.
And then comes Jim Crow, the reassertion of white supremacy. But that was a little later.
Yeah, and I think the popular, you know, belief is that, you know, we had the Civil War and then the rise of Jim Crow, and that's not the case at all. We had the Civil War, then this another 10 or more years of Reconstruction, in which, you know, this flourishing of black democracy I mentioned, and then this kind of drawn out, ambiguous kinds of things until the 1890s and the dawn of the 20th century, when actual Jim Crow constitutions are passed throughout the Deep South. And for Alabama, that was passed in 1901. But what you see, for instance, emerging almost immediately after the end of Reconstruction in Alabama is the rise of convict labor. So a sort of form of neo-slavery where once the federal government retreats and is partially pushed out, really, by militant actions like the massacre in Eufaula, they send African Americans to jail, and from jail they're sent into the mines up near Birmingham to mine coal industry.
Well, you don't deal with Woodrow Wilson's impact here, but didn't he play a role? I mean, they were getting mixed signals from Washington, weren't they, all along?
Oh, right. Yeah, I call this, you know, this is the third section of the book. It's first one is Indian removal. The second one's Reconstruction. This third one I call federal government in repose, which is to say, This is what happens when the federal government is pulling back and sitting on its hands on these questions. And Woodrow Wilson, yeah, I do more with Teddy Roosevelt, actually. But Woodrow Wilson is kind of an emblematic figure because he's the first Southerner back on the national stage. The South has played a disproportionate role in national politics prior to the Civil War. And here we have a Southerner who essentially believes in segregation back in the presidency. And this is means that local and state governments can pretty much do what they want without fear of federal intervention. And so we see the disenfranchisement, the segregationist constitutions, the rise of convict labor, mass lynchings, all sorts of things that are going on because the federal government has turned its back on African Americans in the South.
And didn't Lyndon Johnson work to transform the 1957 Civil Rights Act into the what he called the weakest bill it could possibly be when he was the majority leader?
Yes, he did. I mean, you know, Lyndon Johnson is such a political genius that both sides thought they won the fight over the 57 Civil Rights Act, which is exactly how Lyndon Johnson, you know, wanted things to play out. But that 57 Civil Rights Act, which is it's often forgotten, it's a little toothless, but it did set the stage. You know, first you had, just to back up a little bit, you had Brown versus Board of Education a few years earlier in 1954. And so the turn of the Supreme Court, then the rise, Truman was very important, then the Brown versus Board, then the Civil Rights Act of 57. And But that's what gave Wallace his sort of rocket boosted his political potential, because prior to that he was kind of a populist, let's pave the roads and let's tamp down in the segregation stuff and let's build trade schools and let's see Alabama prosper. After that act, when they demanded the election returns for Barbara County, that's when he became the fighting judge, pushed against the federal government, and realized this is his path to power, was fighting against integration. And specifically, he tried to back off direct attacks on black people and push for a much more sophisticated attack on the federal authority. As you said, it's the oppression was clanking on the horizon in the South. For Wallace, the Civil Rights Act of 57 and beyond were essentially just more bayonets lined up on the horizon that were about to take over Southern sovereignty.
Well, Lyndon Johnson was a Southerner, but in his defense, in 1965, when he was president, he responded to the civil rights struggles by passing the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, amazing story. So Johnson...
So was he betraying the South in a sense? Did people like Wallace see him as a traitor?
Yeah, oh yeah. Many in the Deep South thought that when people on the left and civil rights activists when thought that when Kennedy was assassinated in November 63 and Johnson came into power, that it was all over, right? Because now we just had another Southern segregationist cracker in charge of the federal government and nothing was going to happen. But Johnson was an ambitious, ambitious animal, and he wanted a legacy. He wanted it on his terms. And so with the assassination, the sort of mourning electorate, and his own political acumen, he passes the Civil Rights Act in 64, and then fights very hard for the Voting Rights Act in 65.
Now, didn't President Franklin Delano Roosevelt overlook Jim Crow racism in order to maintain the support of white Southern voters?
Right. This is the irony and the tragedy of the whole New Deal era, is on the one hand...
Because we tend to think of him as a president who was very involved with freedom.
That's
people's
right.
Rights.
Yeah, the four freedoms.
But he also ignored a lot of what was going on in Germany at the time. So he's
right.
A mixed bag.
And the Jews. Yeah, right. So again, we have to think about politics. Roosevelt knew that if he – let me back up real quick. You have to understand the structure of the Democratic Party at that moment. It is a Southern party. It's a Southern and Western party. Now we think of it as a Northeastern party and a West Coast party.
But we used to talk about Southern
the South
Democrats.
Was central to the Democratic Party. And if he alienated the South, the white South, with anything, including anti-lynching legislation, he was afraid he would lose, Social Security. He would lose collective bargaining for workers. He would lose Fair Labor Standards Act. He would lose, everything else. So he steered completely clear of anything that would destabilize the racial order in the Deep South.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Jefferson Cowie. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of the book we've been discussing, Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. Just go online to give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950 during today's show, and we'll be happy to send you a copy. That's give, and then the number 2, WBAI.org, or call 212-209-2950. But don't forget to make that $50 donation, or more, by the way, in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, and we thank you very much. In return to Jefferson Cowie, whose book, Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power, is published by Basic Books. He is the James G. Stallman Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, and also the author of 4 other books. Now, you've said freedom is not something we can automatically take for granted as a good thing. What do you mean by that?
Right. So the way I use freedom, I borrow
from... Isn't it just another word for nothing left to lose? Forgive me. I'm
right. I think we have to see this as a, you know, it's the American creed, right? It's the one thing everybody believes in. This is, you know, the fundamental concept of America. But what does it mean? Nobody knows. And Americans tend to think they're the only ones in the world who enjoy it. And there's an old kind of construct of freedom. There's negative freedom and positive freedom that say you have a negative, you have rights against that people can't take away, like the Bill of Rights. Then you have positive freedoms, like what Franklin Roosevelt offered during the New Deal, that is economic resources so that you can live your life the way you want. But what I do, I'm doing something slightly different. I borrow from a sociologist named Orlando Patterson at Harvard, and he says, he goes back and looks at the entire history of freedom and says, freedom, you could break it apart into 3 parts. It's like a chord of 3 notes. And the first one we all know, it's sort of civil liberties, freedom from oppression. The second one is the... Go ahead.
That's a form of anti-statism, no?
Kind of, yeah. But it is, it's sort of one I think we can get behind, right? The Bill of Rights will prevent you from expressing yourself in a free way. Now, what that gets used for gets complicated. And the second one is the freedom to build your own political community, to vote, to participate in the construction of your community. This is one we never think about. And the third one is the one I'm really thinking about a lot, with to dominate others, even to brutalize others. In some abstract philosophical way, we think that your freedom ends right when you're about to punch me in the nose. But that's not really the case. One's freedom to dominate, freedom to oppress, freedom to seize power is a key element of it. And that's one of the reasons I got into this whole idea, is I began to fear the word freedom as it was used by a lot of people. Right as we speak, a group that runs by the name of the Freedom Caucus is holding up Kevin McCarthy's possibility of being Speaker of the House. So that word freedom is a highly contested concept, and I kind of wanted to unpack that. Look at this freedom to dominate, where it comes from, and how it gets projected on a national stage.
And its meaning has changed a bit over the course of our country. The Bill of Rights didn't apply to state governments, only to what Congress could or could not do before the passage of the 14th Amendment. And then some of those powers were trimmed by the Supreme Court.
That is exactly right. Yeah. And it's really not until, things get advanced and then things pull back, right? So the 14th Amendment promises equal protection to everybody. It doesn't really work out. It's curtailed in the courts quite dramatically. It expands again during the New Deal period. It expands, and then there's a retreat, and then it expands again during the Civil Rights era. And now we're sort of in our own a period of retraction after the last 30 years, I think, in a lot of ways, have been a pullback from the victories of the Civil Rights era, much like, in parallel, though maybe not as dramatic, as the pullback after Reconstruction in which, we're seeing voting rights stripped and contested and fought over. When, in my opinion, the one thing the federal government should be doing is backing every citizen's right to vote unambiguously.
So it's just different tactics are being applied. And today, a lot of gerrymandering has been a major right. factor, and rezoning, redistricting.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, right now, who gets to vote is more important than what people are voting about. Right. That who controls access to the polls in what way, whether it's gerrymandering or elimination of convicts from voting, or purging voters from the registration polls, the whole thing. It's the contest back to the late 19th century. Who gets to vote becomes as important, if not more important, over any particular piece of legislation anybody wants to support.
Should we see the Confederate flags and racist signs at the January 6th Capitol riot as just the most recent manifestation of what you've written about, the presence of the Proud Boys and the KKK?
Yeah,
there is still a KKK?
Yeah, I mean, the KKK is one manifestation of a broad sentiment, and even that has changed over time. It was a terrorist organization in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. It becomes a little more civically minded, but still scary in the 1920s. Then it reemerges in the 1960s, again, as a bit of a terrorist organization. But that's just, I think we get a little too distracted by the KKK. I think there's that problem is all over the place if we look closely. And I think if you scrape below invocations of freedom by a lot of people, you'll find not too dissimilar sentiments, different tactics, perhaps, but similar sentiments.
Are we discussing a current principle of conservative politics, for example, conspiracy theories about the deep state, in the actions of Republican officials like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who built a case for his reelection in 2022 by banning, in the name of individual freedom, classroom discussions of gender, sexuality, and systemic racism?
Yeah, of individual rights and freedoms, which to me seems, stripping academic freedom in the name of individual freedom not to hear ideas strikes me as fundamentally bizarre, yet also connected to this deeper strain that I'm talking about. And going back to Wallace, your opening question, Wallace once said that his American Independent Party he called it the Squirrel Party because it tended to attract all the nuts. And this is the man himself. And so the anti-statist stuff, again, creates a big umbrella from the most whacked out conspiracy theorists to the most tactically wise strategy to reduce taxes, right? So it becomes a really big umbrella that can win elections and provide a kind of cohesion where otherwise there really wouldn't be the type of cohesion we see. So when those guys stormed the Capitol with the Confederate flags and demanding their freedoms and that their government has been taken away from them, that resonates all the way back to the Civil War. It resonates all the way back to the push against Reconstruction, the seizure of Indian lands. I mean, this I know historians tend to make this argument. It was always thus. But I do think.
But it's interesting that we can't move on.
Yeah. There's core principles that we have troubles getting around. And I think I don't want to get overly determinist because I think it's always kind of conflicted. But you can often get back to the twin problems of settler colonialism and chattel slavery, right? And those two things, that we want the land and we want the labor to work it, end up being very powerful progenitors of a great deal of the types of problems that we experience and see today. And I'm not saying, like, you know, this is uncontestable DNA level thinking, but I am saying that there are these core ideas that are loose in political ideology and discourse that don't go away very easily, and it takes a lot to overcome them.
My guest on today's Let It Lopate at Large, here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org, is Jefferson Cowie. His latest book, is Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power, published by Basic Books. You've said that race has to be central to any serious study of American history, and that we need to think more critically about the nation's history and challenge many themes that have been taken for granted for generations. Can you elucidate on that?
that's a big question.
We have a little bit of time.
Let me illustrate it through my own sort of intellectual journey. I kind of thought that if we dealt with class questions, redistribution of wealth questions, and essentially material issues, for a long time, I thought that would be enough. I thought that you could sweep questions of class, of race, in there, and that if everybody had access to good wages and working conditions and health care and housing, we'd be okay. But the more I struggled with these questions and observed politics and kept watching this racial dimensions disturbing or disrupting in very dramatic ways that whole concept, I began to see, you know, we have a lot of work to do on questions of race and how race penetrates so many aspects of American culture, and we need to deal with those before probably we can really get to other questions that I find, you know, personally would like to see more central to American politics, which is how do we divide the pie? But unfortunately, we're too busy fighting over who's real, who has actual claims over things, and who can vote and who can't vote, and whether this is a white person's republic or it's a multicultural democracy.
So how much of a factor do you see this as being in the growing partisanship in this country? In some cases, even when politicians are shown to have been real fools or liars, it doesn't seem to have affected anything because these other things seem to override them.
Right, exactly. And so this goes back, I think, to the post-Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act period, in which we begin to see the South, the white South, flip Republican, a new era of political polarization. You know, there used to be more like four parties, liberal Republicans, conservative Republicans, liberal Democrats, conservative Democrats, kind of working in this mishmash of coalitions in the post-war era. But after the 60s, this gets defined into basically two tribes. And one tribe believes that the country's been taken away from them, basically, that a birthright of whiteness has been taken away. And this also ties into immigration and other things. And others who are prepared to share social and political power. And that's when that sort of fundamental thinking, I think, is at the central turning point of how people think about their politics, it almost doesn't matter what any individual thinks and whether, you know, they're qualified intellectually or politically to hold office. As long as they're representing your tribe, you're going to vote for them. And I think, you know, it's become in some ways more, a little more reified and sticky, and there's less mobility than there was even in the antebellum period, you know, in which there were actually multiple parties vying for political power in Barber County, the Whigs and the Democrats, prior to the Civil War, because they could presume the slave economy. They weren't fighting over that. But now that we're actually, politics is really turning on the question of what the nature of the republic is, I think we have the exact sort of thing that you just said, which is this kind of knee-jerk my guy or the highway kind of politics.
But it isn't just race right now. We, the same people who are engaged in that kind of partisanship, have strong positions on women's issues, on abortion, on sexuality, on gay rights, a whole bunch of other things. Do you see them as all linked together?
Right. That, yeah. So in many ways, we're talking about kind of the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s. And that, you know, yeah, I completely agree with you that it is far more complex than simply race. And I think we'd have to throw immigration in with that stew that you just mentioned, because after the Hart-Celler Act of 1965, which opened up immigration, did away with this sort of race-based immigration pattern that had been instituted in the 1920s.
It took Richard Nixon, was the president who finally signed a bill that allowed Asians to come into this country.
That's
quite late in our history.
The entire history of immigration and how this plays into it is a whole other kind of level. But I think what we see, just to pull the lens back to where you want, is a lot of people feel like they're defending their traditional sensibilities against federal power. So, you know, what happened in the 1960s was not just the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, of course, but on and through the 70s, Roe v. Wade and busing and birth control and affirmative action and all of these efforts, power and rights to those who hadn't had it before. And it comes at through mostly the federal government. And the one thing that I think we often forget is, for instance, to return to civil rights, those protest movements of the 1960s weren't just trying to cross Selma Bridge or weren't just trying to integrate a lunch counter or whatever the case. They were trying to trigger federal intervention. They were trying to create federal citizens rather than local citizens. And that is happening throughout the culture in the post-60s era, in which federal rights and the Bill of Rights becomes federalized, really, after after Brown versus Board and all of the cases that followed in the following 20 years. And so this sense of autonomy, sovereignty, dominion is challenged by the federal government. Let me, if you don't mind, just indulge.
We have just another minute or two left, but
sure,
make your point.
Okay, real quick, the scales fell from my eyes when I was looking at the registration drive after the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and King's Lieutenant Hosea Williams was trying to figure out, well, how come some counties have successful voting rights, voting registration activities, and some don't? And he couldn't figure it out. And then he finally figured out that the difference was certain counties had federal registrars in them, and certain counties didn't, and that the federal government was the guarantor of federal form of rights against local freedoms to deny those rights. And that, in a nutshell, is kind of what this book is about. Hmm.
Some people have wondered whether there's any commonalities between your book and the 1619 Project.
Yes. There are commonalities. I find the 1619 Project a little rigid in its conceptualization of history, like the die was cast, the mold was made, and everything falls forward from that. I see it as a little more dynamic, a little more fluid, a little more contested, but we are struggling with the same basic questions about rethinking the centrality of race in American political development.
Jefferson Cowie is the James G. Stallman Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, the author of four books, the most recent, the one we've been discussing, Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power, published by Basic Books. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book.
And that brings us to the end of our show. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more about one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access our nearly 700 past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. Our podcast, which has surpassed 1 million plays, is available on iTunes, Apple, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@WBAI.org. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI. We're at the beginning of a new year, but we are still suffering from some of the problems that we suffered in the past year. We're a little behind on our rent, and we're a little behind on paying for our broadcast tower. And we hope that listeners who have the means to do so will make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with. And you can do that by calling 212-209-2950 or by going online to give2wbai.org right now. We need your help to keep bringing you this unique, in-depth content, information you don't usually get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of this show, London Lopate at Large, can receive a copy of the book that we've been discussing, Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power, by Jefferson Cowie. So why not make that call right now at 212-209-2950 or go online to give2wbai.org. And, you know, you might also consider becoming a sustaining member of the station, what we call a BAI buddy. And you can do that by agreeing to give us $10 a month, $15 a month, $20 a month, as long as you are willing to do that. And it allows us to plan for the future and not have to worry about being in the kind of hole we're in right now. So, and if you become a BAI buddy, we'll say thank you with a tote bag, a BAI tote bag, for anyone who becomes one for $10 a month or more. And $10 a month, if you figure it out by the day, it's just a few pennies a day. But either way, I hope that you'll call right now, because WBI relies totally on listener donations. We don't take ads or foundation grants, which allows us to be completely free speech radio. So if you tune in regularly to this show, why not let us know that you appreciate what we do by going to give2wbai.org or by calling 212-209-2950 to play a part in keeping this historic station, the only one on the New York radio dial that is 100% listener-sponsored, alive and thriving with your tax-deductible support. And we hope you can join us tomorrow when we'll discuss an important new film called The Invisible Extinction. We'll see you then.
Hello, WBAI listeners and supporters. If you appreciate interacting with members of the WBAI local station board, then tune in Tuesday, January 3rd from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. for the next report from the WBAI local station board. This month, you'll hear from various members of the board. And as usual, they'll talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network, and they'll ask you for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI. So don't let this opportunity pass you by. Be sure to tune in. Again, that's Tuesday, January 3rd, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. for the next report from the WBAI local station board. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
WBAI's local station board, the Civica Foundation board responsible for advising management and operations, is holding its next meeting on Wednesday, January 11th at 7 p.m., and you are invited to attend. The LSB expects to elect its Pacifica National Board members at the meeting. They will represent WBAI on the national level. It's immediately essential that Pacifica Network stations, WBAI included, find their financial footing. If we fail to distinguish ourselves, increase our donating listener audience, our already shoestring budget and outstretched staff will likely be cut, and vitally important assets may get sold. But the LSB is working to ensure that a robust WBAI 99.5 FM remains where you can find it, at 99.5 FM in the center of the dial. Again, the LSB meeting is January 11th at 7 p.m. on Zoom. The meeting includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join a meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org and on the WBAI website, wbai.org. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. That's 929-205-6099. And enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. That's 922-457-2995. The password is 995, like WBAI frequency, 99.5. So it's 995-995-99. Please join us.
Hey, I can't find nothing on the radio.
Well, tune in to WBAI and you certainly will get an earful.
You'll turn to that station.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
And you can ensure that WBAI is here for you now and in the future through WBAI's Tower Fund. Go to towerfund.wbai.org and contribute what you can to ensure that the room which houses WBAI's transmitter at 4 Times Square, which costs $17,000 a month, is paid through the coming year. Please go to towerfund.wbai.org or phone 212-209-2950 to help secure WBAI's future.
Hey, thank you to all of you for contributing. And we hope that you are, we hope that you will decide to make a contribution in support of this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station.
And the previous program was Leonard Lopate at Large, heard Monday through Friday, usually at 1 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Quantum Medicine with Dr. Kamal Kakai. And while that program is on the air, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. That's give to the number 2 WBAI.org online. Alrighty, it is now 2 p.m. Stay tuned for Quantum Medicine coming up.